Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. It's a good day. It's a good time to get to talk about what God has given us. This week, we are talking about the fourth petition, give us this day our daily bread. What does this mean? God certainly gives us daily bread, gives daily bread to everyone without our prayers, even to all evil people. But we pray in this petition that God would lead us to realize this and to receive our daily bread with thanksgiving. And what is meant by daily bread? Daily bread includes everything that has to do with the support and needs of the body, such as food, drink, clothing, shoes, house, home, land, animals, money, goods, a devout husband or wife, devout children, devout workers, devout and faithful rulers, good government, good weather, peace, health, self-control, good reputation, good friends, faithful neighbors, and the like. God gives us all that we need, yet we pray in this petition, give us this day our daily bread, that we might be thankful for what God provides for us. Today we're going to talk about the complexity of the design of the human body, and so we're going to go to the Concordia Center for Bioethics at Concordia University, Wisconsin here in just a minute. I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting the program. To find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin, just go to our website, kfuo.org. Look for the sponsor section there. You'll find the CUW logo and click on that. That'll take you to their page. You can find out about the programs and the locations where Concordia University, Wisconsin is available. Well, joining us by phone today, our guest is the Reverend Dr. Kevin Voss. He's the director of the Concordia Center for Bioethics and associate professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Good morning, Dr. Voss.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being our guest today on Faith and Family.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, tell us about your background. You have, looking at all the letters, all the appellations after your name, man, you have quite a background. The Reverend Dr. Kevin Voss with quite a just an amazing background. And when looking at all your education, how did you get to where you are? What all have you studied along the way?
Well, I grew up in a small dairy farm near Brilliant, Wisconsin, which is in northeast Wisconsin, and had typically had good experience at school, and I loved animals, so I thought I would try to be a veterinarian, in particular a large animal veterinarian, and taking care of dairy cattle. So that's what I decided to do. I went to high school at Manitowoc Lutheran High School here in northeast Wisconsin, and then from there went to the University of Minnesota, where I did my undergraduate work, and then I was accepted to the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine and graduated there in 1981 and started practice in a little mixed practice in the town of Bondiwell, which is a town of about 1,000 in northeast Wisconsin, about 30 miles northwest of Green Bay, and I practiced there for 14 years, and most of my practice was concentrated on dairy animals, reproductive medicine in particular, and did some small animals, dogs and cats, also did a few pigs, a few horses, but mainly dairy practice was my emphasis. Unfortunately, as time went on, particularly the last couple of years, I started having trouble with asthma. I did have asthma from childhood on, but it was definitely under control in my early adult years, but then it seemed like every year it got worse. And I wasn't allergic to cows per se, but just about everything around a cow, hay, straw, dust. And in order to keep my asthma under control, I was under the care of an allergist in Green Bay. He put me on oral prednisone, which is a steroid, and that has several side effects, including risk of diabetes. But one thing it can also do is weaken your bone structure. So one day I was working on a cow, doing one of the glory jobs of a large animal vet. I was trimming a sore foot on a cow, which was a fun job, kind of a messy job. And this cow was a huge cow, probably about 1,700 pounds at least. Her back was as tall as my head, and I'm about 6 feet tall. And she was able to squirm away from my restraints and kick my right leg and broke it in three different places. So that gave me time to think about my future. And actually, at the urging of my pastor, he said, why don't you think about a second career in the ministry? Because I knew I couldn't stay in practice too much longer. I had to either do something else in veterinary medicine, like teach at a veterinary school or work for industry or for the state of Wisconsin, or go into a different field. And so long story short, my wife and I decided to share my part of the practice, sell my part of the practice. We moved down to St. Louis, and I attended seminary there for 4 years and graduated in 1999. And as I was nearing graduation, several members of the faculty said, gee, you should think about teaching bioethics because we need people to teach bioethics. Professor Robert Weiss served as one of my mentors there at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, as well as Professor Wayne Schmidt, who had passed away, sadly, several years ago. But they encouraged me to think about perhaps checking out a program at St. Louis University where they happen to have a PhD program in healthcare ethics. And bioethics was actually the perfect place for me because it combines theology, philosophy, and medicine into one package. So after I finished my classroom work and my comprehensive oral and written exams, Concordia University found out about me here and brought me on board in fall of 2003. So I've been here since 2003.
Wow. It's quite a journey from studying veterinary medicine and practice there to coming to seminary, getting a theological education, and then a doctorate in bioethics. Just what a background. It's kind of a unique experience. I don't know if there are a lot of people with that kind of background, huh?
No, none that I know of, none with that specific background. But it seems like the Lord was using me and had something in mind for me right from the beginning. It seemed like one experience led to the next, and I often tell people sometimes the Lord drags you kicking and screaming into what he wants you to do. Sometimes he uses a cow to break your leg. But eventually you end up where you're supposed to be, and happy I'm able to serve him in his kingdom here at Concordia University.
Absolutely, and what a joy it is. You serve as director of Concordia Center for Bioethics.
Yes.
What is the Center for Bioethics there at Concordia?
The Concordia Center for Bioethics is a Christian academic center that applies God's word to issues involving biology and healthcare through teaching, service, and research. So bioethics is simply two words squashed together, mm-hmm. biology and ethics. And it used to be hyphenated, and now it's just simply one word. And it actually came into being as a field in the early 1970s, particularly when issues involving end of life began to pop up, like ventilators and feeding tubes. People had questions about when do we disconnect ventilators and feeding tubes? When is it appropriate? When is it inappropriate? Then there were also issues that materialized in the 1960s about research ethics, human subject research, where ethical atrocities came to light, such as injecting live cancer cells into Jewish patients in the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital in Brooklyn, New York. And then Tuskegee syphilis study also came in mind, where 400 black men in Macon County, Alabama, were used as test subjects studying the long-term effects of syphilis, and they weren't even told they were in a study. They weren't even told that they weren't receiving treatment. Some of them didn't even know they had syphilis. So those issues popped up, and then as well as 1978, first test tube baby came into being, Elizabeth Brown. Louise Brown. So all those things happened at one time, and it seemed like there was a need for people to study these kind of issues and try to decide how to best approach those issues from an ethical perspective. So that's what we try to do here at Concordia University. Of course, our emphasis is from a Lutheran Christian confessional perspective based on the Word of God, which is really unique among other bioethics centers.
That in itself is a bioethics and why we believe what we do about creation, about the human body and how it's designed is probably a conversation we could have for hours on end, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
And we'll get to, I think today we'll touch on just one part of that, looking at the complexity and the beauty of the design of the human body. Before we get to that, though, just a little bit more about the Concordia Center for Bioethics. What are some of the courses that you teach there?
I teach a general bioethics course, a 300-level course that's really targeted for juniors, and it's required of exercise physiology students here. Many of them end up going into occupational therapy and physical therapy graduate programs. Mm-hmm. It's also required of pre-pharmacy students here. We have a pharmacy school which started about 4 years ago, and we're actually the only second university in the whole state of Wisconsin that has a pharmacy school, and no other Concordia System school has a pharmacy school. We're actually starting a new program, a Doctor of Optometry program here. So that's something new that they're working to get on board. So we're excited about that. And actually, I'll be teaching an ethics course for physician assistants here this summer. We just started about 2 years ago a program for physician assistants. So we have tons of healthcare programs, including nursing, parish nursing, master's level nursing, and doctorate in nursing practice as well, and then of course pre-medical programs. So we have, it seems like Concordia has really emphasized recently a lot of healthcare programs. So that's why it's a perfect place for a bioethics center, because they need people to teach medical ethics courses. I also teach some philosophy courses and also a religion course, Christian ethics, too. So that's generally what I teach here.
Why is it important for students at that level, whether undergrad or graduate, to have these courses in bioethics when they are preparing for a career work in a medical field?
When I was a veterinarian, when you first graduate, you know, from a medical program, you're first concerned about doing things the right way. You know, the technical aspect of it. Can I hit this vein? Am I selecting the correct drug? Am I doing the surgery properly? And that's what you really concern yourself probably with for the first years you're in practice. But then, after a while, practice becomes routine. You've seen things at least once if you've been in practice 5 years, and you feel fairly confident that you can handle almost any situation that arises. But the things that really stick with you are the ethical issues. Should I have done this? Should I have done that? You know, should I have handled this client in a different way? And I always tell my students that the ethical issues are the things that'll stick with you your entire lives, for sure during your professional career. Unfortunately, many students in professional programs across the country really don't get a solid basis for ethical decision making, and that's what I try to do with my students. I instruct them about the principles of biomedical ethics and all the stuff they get at secular institutions, but I teach them how to approach an ethical decision in a reasonable, biblically-based manner, and then I instill in them Christian ethical principles that would inform them and really sets them apart from other healthcare professionals. As an example, our nursing program, I know, has typically received accolades from hospitals in the area because they always enjoy hiring our nursing students because they generally are dependable, show up for work, they try to do the best possible job they can. Not that other programs don't graduate good nursing students, but it just seems that good, solid ethical grounding based on law and gospel God's word is really important. For example, the golden rule, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. A lot of ethics courses don't even discuss that, or the so-called second greatest commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. Those sorts, and a good grounding in the Ten Commandments, just basic things like that really help graduates as they head out into the real world. And mm-hmm. Practicing in the real world is not easy.
What about understanding the design of the human body? You know, in Luther's Small Catechism, we learn that God provides for us all that we need in body and soul. Mm-hmm. And in God's Word, we read that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. How does understanding alone, that God is the creator, the designer, he's the giver of all good things, How is that important in a medical or health related career?
Well, I think there are two basic perspectives on the human body. One is that it's just a machine, you know, that there's really nothing beyond what we can see. So if we understand this machine correctly, we should be able to fix it. And with that perspective, sometimes people are treated like machines, they're treated like things, versus the biblical point of view that every person is a unique individual, that every person is created in the image and likeness of God, that each person is important and should be treated, as a philosopher named Immanuel Kant said, as an end in of themselves and not as a means to an end. So each person has inherent dignity and value. And in fact, we teach a course here as part of our bioethics undergraduate minor. We have a minor in bioethics now, which is just starting this fall. So anyone who's considering coming to Concordia University as an undergraduate student, I would encourage you to think about taking that as a minor. But we have a course in human dignity, which will actually be taught by one of the world's most foremost scholars, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, who's coming here on faculty this fall.
Wow.
And we're happy to have him here. So he will be teaching that course, and that's one of the core courses for our undergraduate minor. We also have, if you don't mind if I mention, we have a graduate certificate in bioethics that's open to anyone with a bachelor's degree, no matter where they got it, whatever institution, as long as they had a GPA of 3.0 or above, so B or above, and it's five courses. And if you complete the five courses, then you have a graduate certificate in bioethics. And the courses are really interesting. In fact, we're working on developing them now. Moral reasoning and bioethics is one of them. Professor Greg Schultz is on faculty as well. He was formerly on faculty at Wisconsin Lutheran College. He's well known in our synod. He's teaching that one. Clinical issues in bioethics. We also have a third course in bioethics and biotechnology, which will be taught by Reverend Robert Fleischman of Christian Life Resources. Bioethics and the law, and then finally policy issues in bioethics. So any of your listeners who are interested in earning a graduate certificate in bioethics, and these courses will be taught online, so they're available to anyone in the country as long as they have a computer. They can take it by distance learning. And so I invite people to think about that.
Certainly. If the conversation today makes you think more, and you want to dig in more to that to this topic, then that would be, certainly be a great route to go. Well, what does the complexity and the design of the human body say about the Creator? We were talking about just a little bit ago how there are two different views of the human body. One is that it's just a machine, and the other view views it as a person created with intention and intelligence behind that design.
Right. In fact, I just have a few factoids I can just give to your listeners. Actually, you can get these things online at different places. This actually happened to have a handout here from Dr. Scott Stoll Ministries. Just a few facts about the human body. A sneeze can exceed the speed of 100 miles an hour.
I bet mine would be even faster.
And that you have from 5 to 6 quarts of blood in your body. That's actually the amount of oil used in an average V8 engine. Average human scalp has 100,000 hairs. Actually, blondes have more hair than darker-haired people, ironically. If you turn 70, by the time you turn 70, your heart will have beat some 2.5 billion times. You know, it's just amazing. Each square inch of the human skin consists of 20 feet of blood vessels. That's every square inch.
Wow.
Everyone has a unique tongue print, believe it or not. I don't know how they would do that at police stations, but actually that every square inch, this might make you feel a little bit creepy. Every square inch of the human body has an average of 32 million bacteria on it. And if removed from your body, small intestine would stretch to a length of 22 feet. So those are just some things that, you know, just tell you how amazing and how complex the human body is. The human body is, every cell in the human body is more complex than the space shuttle, which is considered to be the most complex machine ever built in human history. Some research that's just been done, or at least some books that have been published within the last 20 years, just incredible. I know two people in particular that have done work in this area, Dr. David Menton of Answers in Genesis, perhaps you've had him as a guest. He actually taught anatomy at a medical school there at St. Louis University in St. Louis. But he talks about, for example, the complexity of the human eye, where it's just impossible to believe that there's not really some sort of design behind the eye and how it could have just happened randomly. For example, you have to have a cornea, which is a clear window to the eye that focuses most of the light. And then you have an iris behind the eye that controls how much light enters the eye, just like a camera. It's very similar to a camera, actually. And then we have a second lens behind the iris that's rubbery and can stretch and contract to enable the image to focus. Our eye has unique things like a black coating on the inside in order to keep random light from bouncing around, just like the inside. If you ever open up a old brownie camera, it was coated black, just like that. And then, not only that, the inside of the eye is filled with a jelly-like substance, unlike a camera, which is just air inside. And that jelly-like substance actually helps concentrate the light much better to the back of the eye. And the back of the eye, of course, is where the retina is located, and that's just like film, camera film, or like the CCD chip in our current digital cameras. And then not only that, to move the eye, there are three pairs of muscles to move it in all different directions. We have an automatic washer-wiper system known as eyelids and tears that clean our eyeballs for us, unlike a camera. And unlike a camera, if the eye is injured, it'll repair itself if the damage isn't too major. So, and if any one of these parts breaks down, any one of these parts, the eye will not work as it should. So the eye itself is just, I think, in my mind, an example of the wonderful complexity of the human body. And that's just the eye.
We're only at the top of the body right now. We haven't even covered the rest of the systems. Just the eye, as you were talking about, just in the eye, is that the fluid in the eye? Is that the optic fluid or something like that, I believe?
Yeah. It's like a jelly. It's a jelly-like substance that's inside the eye. That the whole eye is full of that stuff, and then it helps to vitreous humor, I believe it's called. It's helps transmit the light from the front of the eye, where that second lens is located, to the back of the eye, so that it gives the eye a firmness as well, you know, so it can move around more easily, but then it just transmits light much better than just an empty space would.
What does this, just looking at that alone, just the eye, we haven't even gotten to the rest of the systems in the body, but just looking at that alone, what does that say about the design and the designer of the human body?
Just tells you that the designer is unbelievably intelligent. And we actually just saw an article the other day about things in nature that we have seen, that we see that we're actually using to make devices for ourselves, like even bat radar, for example, you know, gave researchers the idea of radar. So it tells you he's intelligent, tells you that he thinks rationally, just like we are, because we're created in with that characteristic as well, that he plans ahead, that everything has a plan. And that's actually a key aspect we discuss in our philosophy courses, the whole idea of a final cause. The philosopher Aristotle wrote about four causes that he thought were major parts of the universe. For example, material cause is the matter that everything is made out of. And the efficient cause is the person who makes the matter into something, like the baker baking a cake. And then there's a formal cause, which is, let's say, the baker takes the bread or takes the dough, makes it into a birthday cake. That would be the formal cause the thing that it's made into. So in this case, it would be the eye. But the final cause is actually the key one. That is the purpose for which the cake was intended. So perhaps it might be intended as a birthday celebration for my wife, for example. The final cause postulates that everything is created for a reason, for a purpose. And Aristotle actually thought that. And so did Thomas Aquinas, who studied Aristotle and brought many facets of his beliefs into the Christian church, particularly the Roman Catholic Church. But the whole idea that everything is made with a purpose, with a plan. So, of course, not only is creation, everything that was created by God, have a purpose or a plan, similar to the purpose of a knife is to cut. The eye's purpose is to see so that we can get along in the world. But the ultimate final cause, of course, is that all of history centers on Christ, that everything has been planned from the beginning so that as many people can be saved as possible because of the suffering, death, and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. And we believe all of history centers on the crucifixion and the resurrection and everything that came before and after. So I think just looking at creation tells you that the designer has a final goal in mind, a purpose for everything. And it's very difficult to look at something and feel that it's just random, you know, that we're just here by accident, especially if you look at the complexity of these structures. And we haven't even gotten to the complexity of the cell yet, which is unbelievably complex, and they're finding out more and more of those things as time goes on.
Well, let's do that. We need to take a break, but when we come back from the break, we'll continue talking about the other systems and just the beauty and the complexity of the design of the human body. Today, we're talking with Reverend Dr. Kevin Voss, director of the Concordia Center for Bioethics and associate professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Stick around for more Faith and Family right after this break, and we'll continue the conversation.
Worldwide KFUO is the most trusted place for sacred music of the church, where every night of the year you can hear sacred music. Weeknights at 6 p.m., listen to sacred music on AM 850 KFUO in St. Louis, as well as streaming online at kfuo.org. Our online stream is in high-quality stereo, so you can hear the difference wherever you listen, on your computer, on Wi-Fi radio, and on your smartphone. We're Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
For years, Planned Parenthood's been telling us that millions of women won't get crucial health care if we don't give them our tax dollars. But in Ohio alone, there's over 600 community health centers providing free or low-cost care to women who need it. When you add the 125 pro-life women health centers, women don't need Planned Parenthood at all. These community centers serve a 500,000 women in a given year, five times the number of Planned Parenthood. Ohio's probably no different than all the other states. This means the $1 million Planned Parenthood gets each day in federal tax dollars should come to an abrupt end. Please support state and federal efforts to end tax funding of America's largest chain of abortion mills.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Hi, this is Rod Zwanitzer, KFUO's director, asking you to join us for Share-a-thon 2014, April 24th through the 26th. During Share-a-thon, we'll have many special guests and share how KFUO has touched the lives of our listeners with this Christ-centered message. Also during Share-a-thon, we'll ask you for your support and share with you how your gifts will help KFUO share the gospel of Jesus with a world that so desperately needs him. Please prayerfully consider making a gift this year during Share-a-thon 2014 and celebrate the ministry with us Thursday and Friday, April 24th and 25th from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. and on Saturday, April 26th, 7 a.m. till noon. We are the messenger of good news worldwide, KFUO.
Neither his friends nor his enemies could argue that the great leader was dead. Even so, rumors began to circulate and people began to believe that their leader was not in his grave. Sound familiar? Well, perhaps it is not as familiar as you might think.
Pastor Ken Klaus, this week on The Lutheran Hour.
Sundays at 12:30 and 5 p.m. on Worldwide KFUO.
The priests who investigated the lives of Pope John Paul II and Pope John XXIII say they found abundant evidence for the pontiff's canonization as saints. The Polish Monsignor spearheading John Paul's sainthood told reporters through a translator that when the future pontiff was a university student,
there's a time when he was walking down the hall and his classmates say to him, "Hey, there's the future saint."
And as Pope, John Paul taught that
man has to live his life in such a way that his own life is an expression of God's glory.
The Italian priest who investigated the life of Pope John XXIII said the pontiff who convened the Second Vatican Council more than 50 years ago described his life.
In one of the reflections, he says both obedience and peace are his own story and his own life. It was a self-definition.
John XXIII and John Paul II will be canonized as Catholic saints at a Vatican ceremony this Sunday. I'm Steve Coleman.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Today we are talking with Reverend Dr. Kevin Voss, Director of the Concordia Center for Bioethics and Associate Professor of Philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin, about the complexity and beauty of the design of the human body. Dr. Voss, before we went to break, we started with just one system. We started talking about the eye and the complexity of that, and you mentioned that we haven't even gotten to the design of the cell. What is it? Tell us about just the cell itself. How is that complex?
More and more is being learned about the cell as time goes on. In fact, when Charles Darwin wrote Origin of Species, for example, he didn't really understand what went on in each cell. In fact, he didn't even probably realize what each cell does. So that's why it's referred to as sort of a black box today. It's like, well, he knew certain things happened, but couldn't explain how they happened. But now we actually know that the cell is incredibly complex. In fact, one person wrote quite a bit in this area called Michael Behe, who is actually a biologist, and he lives in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And he was a professor of biology at Lehigh University. But he wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box, in which he describes different structures from a microscopic level. Bacteria, for example, or cells in the human body. For example, some cells have structures called cilia. Cilia are little hair-like structures that beat in a coordinated manner in order to move things along, such as in our trachea, the tube that leads to our lungs. When things get into our lungs that shouldn't be there, there are little microscopic cilia on the walls of the trachea that just push the matter up into our throat so we can cough or spit it out and get rid of those offending things. Like, for example, if we swallow water and it goes down the wrong pipe, you know, then the cilia will bring that up to the surface so we can get rid of it. And the complexity of just the cilia is just unbelievable because they all beat in a coordinated manner. So it's just not an uncoordinated bunch of cells just doing their work. And Behe states, for example, the function of the cilium is to be a motorized paddle. In order to achieve this function, microtubules, nexin linkers, and motor proteins all have to be ordered in a precise fashion. They have to recognize each other intimately and interact exactly. The function is not present if any of the components is missing. So it's a very complex type of organization that goes into the cells like that. And bacterium, for example, a bacteria, if you look at a bacterium that can move through fluid, many of them have a structure called a flagellum. And a flagellum is like a long cilia. It's like a long hair-like structure that actually serves like a motorboat engine. And inside the cell is a structure that is essentially a motor made of molecules that everything has to be there in order for that psyllium to whip around hundreds of times a second in order for the bacterium to move around. So it's very incredibly complex structures, and even moving energy around the cell is much more complex than it was thought. And the DNA in our cells, for example, a lot of it was thought to be non-functional DNA, and now they're finding out that all the DNA has a purpose. Some of the DNA is used to build structures made out of protein, but then you also need DNA that serve as sort of an architect's blueprint, where to put all of the structures, and we're just only beginning to understand those things. The brain, they used to think that, well, 3/4 of our brain really, you know, is an untapped resource that really does not function. Well, now we're starting to realize that all the brain is there, we need all of it, and that it all has a function, and we're only just starting to scratch the surface.
Wow, that's interesting, because I remember learning in high school that that we only use a small portion of, mm-hmm. of our brain.
Yeah, that was kind of the misnomer going around, and certainly we could probably utilize more of our brain than we could, both on an intentional level and perhaps on a physical level, but because of sin, all of our brain is not utilized like it should be. But there's much, much more structure there. There's just much more there than what scientists have even anticipated, and it's really going to be exciting in the next 20 to 30 years to see what they discover, not only in anatomy on a gross level, you know, on a level that we can see, but also on a microscopic level.
You brought up a good point. Because of sin, because of our fall, we don't necessarily use all of the brain. Where else in the body do you see the fall of man? Where else do you see sin at work in the human body?
Just looking at the breakdown and processes that occur as we age, you can certainly see. In fact, I'm working on a sermon right now and based on 1 Corinthians 15, 51 through 57, talking about the sting of death is sin. And you can certainly see that. I can certainly see that from a perspective as a healthcare professional and just in my personal life. In fact, I just lost my 98-year-old father last month, and he actually was fairly healthy most of his life. He did have trouble with senile dementia, but the last 2 months in particular, it's almost like everything crashed at one time. It's like his kidneys stopped working, and his nervous system wasn't working like it was. If you couldn't even touch him, and he would cry out in pain. So it was incredibly hard for nurses to transfer him from his chair to a wheelchair, for example. Everything just seemed to cease at one time. And you see that with disease in particular, that things, because of one reason or other, aren't working like they're designed. We have a custodian here at Concordia who, unfortunately, I won't give his name, but he's had trouble with an infection in his arm with one of these flesh-eating bacteria. And they don't even know where he got it from, but he finally recovered to the point where he could return to work, and now reading the prayers today that he's come down with it again. So you can certainly see sin in the breakdown of the normal processes, and so that's why we can certainly look forward to the time when we will be resurrected with a new glorified bodies, where our bodies will work as they were intended to be, that they'll be perfect, where we don't have to worry about illnesses or diseases anymore or death.
Mm. You know, quite often when we think about aging, we think, oh, well, that's just a part of life. Well, it is, you know, aging and even death, we think of as just a part of life, but it's really a part of the fall, correct?
Right. Exactly. In fact, when we talk about this issue, end-of-life issues, in my healthcare ethics classes, particularly with nursing students, sometimes I teach teach an ethics class to nurses who are already nurses, but they just never completed their bachelor's degree for some reason or the other, and they come back here to Concordia to complete their bachelor's degree. So they have a better opportunity at moving up in their careers. And some of them mention, well, we talk about what do you tell your patients and their families when people are nearing death. And some of the nurses mention that, well, what they do tell them is that death is just a part of the circle of life, that it's a natural process. And then I ask them, do you really think that's comforting? You know, is that something that's really comforting for a family? And what does the Bible have to say about those types of issues? And really gets them to think. And at least I would suspect that families probably are not comforted by that sort of phrase, because when they see their loved one dying, it's hard not to appreciate that there's something unnatural going on here. This isn't what we were intended to do. We're not intended to die. When you see a person dying, it's usually not a pleasant experience, although we try to make it as pleasant as possible and comforting as possible, or as pleasant as possible for the person, but it's still not natural. And death is unnatural. It's a ripping asunder of the body from the soul. And we're intended to have body and soul together. That's how we were created, and that's restored again at the resurrection. Unlike Greek philosophers who thought that death was a good thing because it freed us from the body, they saw the body as something evil or imperfect, and that the soul was perfect and part of the divine. That isn't what St. Paul told them in Athens at all. He said that we will be resurrected on the last day. So you're right. Death is not natural. That doesn't mean we have to paint a gorier picture than we have to at the end of life. But I think it's good to be truthful to patients and their families and just say that, yes, death is a part of life, but it's not a natural part of life. Mm-hmm. Now, that part the healthcare professional doesn't have to say, but it's not part of the circle of life. That's actually a paganistic idea that appeared in The Lion King, and a lot of people still refer to death that way.
Sure. It's a part of natural life, but mm-hmm. this fallen natural life. It's,
right.
It's not part of the design that God had intended, as you said, that the our lives, our human bodies, our bodies would be perfect were it not for sin.
Definitely part of our sinful nature, right, and as a result of our sinful nature.
Other systems in the body that you look at or that you've studied that are just fascinating or that show complexity or beauty in design?
Well, just a couple observations. When I went through veterinary school, I had to take a class called histology, which is essentially the study of cells at the microscopic level. So what the instructors would do is they would take a kidney, for example, and cut it into really thin pieces, put it onto a slide, and then have those slides in a box for us to look at. We had to memorize all the little structures, all the little tubules and structures in the kidney, for example. And I remember thinking about all the complex organization that's there, especially in a structure like the kidney or even in the brain. It's so complex, in fact, at first glance it seems random, but then when you start studying the structures, you realize that there's an incredible complexity that's there, that's so complex that we can't even fathom it, that it just seems random at first. So I remember looking at a kidney for the first time as a veterinary student thinking, wow, there's just so much here. Even looking at the skin, I believe Dr. Menton even gives a lecture about sweat glands in the skin and how incredibly complex even our sweat glands are. And saliva. You know, salivary glands. Do you know that by the end of your life, you secrete enough saliva or spit in your mouth that you can fill two swimming pools? So each structure in the body is just very complex. And another example I can use that I use in my article in the Lutheran Witness last January was the blood clotting system. When you're a medical student learning the blood clotting system, it'll just drive you crazy because there are so many blood clotting factors. And if any of your listeners get a chance, if you just Google blood clotting system, you'll see the structure that's there of all the different factors that come into play. When you think about it, when you cut yourself, an incredibly complex system begins, because if the clotting system doesn't work appropriately, if, for example, your blood were like water and it would just start coming out, you would eventually bleed to death.
Right.
But if you cut yourself, if your blood clotting system started working when it wasn't supposed to, then you would get blood clots in your vessels and you would have stroke, heart attack, or part of your limb might actually die because it wouldn't get an adequate amount of blood. So there's a delicate balance that occurs in the blood clotting system. There, for example, there are two different pathways having numerous components that are finely tuned so that blood coagulates when there's an injury, but then flows freely in the body to prevent a blockage that would result in a stroke. So, for example, one quote from one of the authors, in fact, it's Behe, said, "The function of the blood clotting system is as a strong but transient barrier." That's another thing. Once the clotting has stopped and healing has occurred in that site that's scratched, for example, then the blood clot has to disappear. That's another actually incredibly complicated process. But he goes on to say the components of the system are ordered to that end, and then you just list some of the factors: fibrinogen, plasminogen, thrombin, protein C, Christmas factor, there's actually a blood clotting factor called Christmas factor, and the other components of the pathway together do something that none of the components can do alone. In fact, vitamin K is a very important component of our blood clotting system. If a person has a shortage of vitamin K in that person's system, then the whole system crashes. In fact, we used to give vitamin K injections to dairy cattle who had trouble with blood appearing in the milk, you know, when they were secreting milk. So we would give them injections of vitamin K, which seemed to actually help eliminate that problem.
Well, I know in the hospital, at least here in the hospital in where we delivered our where my wife delivered our child about 8 months ago, they give a vitamin K injection before circumcision.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
to promote clotting so that to prevent bleeding.
Yeah, so prevent excessive blood loss.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's just fascinating thinking about, as you were talking about, how if it clots at the wrong time, then it creates a problem. If it doesn't clot at all, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Now, what was the Christmas...
Christmas factor.
Factor. What is? I just had to ask. It sounds intriguing.
Well, off the top of my head, I can't even tell you what it does because it's so complex. But that's for a microbiologist or a biochemist to tell you. But it certainly does play a role in that whole clotting tree that comes down, and it probably would take an hour to explain how it works.
I'm just curious how it got that.
Biochemistry, for example.
Sure. I'm just curious how it got that name. It must have something to do with gifts or presents then, right?
Probably was discovered at Christmas time, uh-huh. I would imagine. That's just a guess off the top of my head. Some of these factors have people's names attached to them. That's actually the case in a lot of anatomy and diseases as well, such as Down syndrome, mm-hmm. a name for a guy named Down. So it's just depends on who happens to discover it and when.
Looking at you have a strong background in science and medicine and in theology, and some might think today that science and religion are incompatible. What is your response to that?
A couple things. One is, in order to make solid ethical decisions, you need to know the facts. So in any time you're faced with a serious ethical dilemma, a situation where there are multiple courses of action and none of them are ideal, and you try to make the most God-pleasing decision possible, it's very difficult to make a good decision if you don't know the basic facts or even the science of the issue. For example, another complex system in our body is the reproductive system. And in my bioethics classes, I give lectures on infertility issues and in vitro fertilization. and all of the different hormones that are come into play in order for a conception to occur. It's just incredible. And if any one of those hormones are missing or not working right, then a woman will not be able to conceive. So all those things are just so incredibly complex. And but actually, they're understandable, and that's actually my main purpose here as director of the Concordia Center for Bioethics, as well as all of our academic programs, is to explain the basic facts and science of an issue so that people can understand them, people without any medical training or without really much biology experience or classes in biology, that they can grasp the main facts of the issue that's important for them. So that's one area that science and ethics and theology are completely intertwined, because you need to know the facts, and when it comes to bioethics, the basic science of an issue, in order to make the best God-pleasing decision possible, in order to apply the proper ethical principles or the proper theological principles to come up with the correct decision. In fact, that's actually one area I feel I can help pastors with, because many pastors, they all know the theology, particularly pastors in Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, they get an excellent education in theology at our seminaries, but some of them are afraid of the science. They're afraid that they won't be able to understand it. But you need to know the science in order to actually apply the correct theology. Another issue regarding science and theology is that the Lord invented science. So if it were inherently evil in and of itself, if it were anti-theology or anti-Christian teaching, why is the Lord inventing all these miraculous things? Why did he, and why does he continue to care for creation on an ongoing basis? It's his idea to begin with, to invent physics and biology and DNA and the eye and all of these structures. So if science were inherently evil, just the study of those structures were inherently evil, then why would the Lord be involved? In fact, most of the early scientists, going all the way back to the ancient Greek times, were Christians. In fact, in the late Middle Ages or the early Enlightenment era, most of the scientists were Christians. And the reason why they felt they could study science to begin with was that they knew that the creation here was logical. They depended on that assumption, that creation is logical, reasonable, just like our Creator is. Our Creator created us as logical, reasonable people that can grasp these issues. So therefore, the basic assumption is that creation can be understood with the use of our minds, was a basic presupposition for the whole area of science to begin with. And without that assumption, it really doesn't pay to even study science if nature is just entirely random.
What a just a great topic. I'm sure that we could probably talk for more hours, but our time is coming to an end. I want to say thanks, Dr. Voss, for taking time today. We've been talking with the Reverend Dr. Kevin Voss. He is the director of the Concordia Center for Bioethics and associate professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Dr. Voss, thanks for being our guest today on Faith and Family.
Oh, you're welcome.
It was a pleasure to talk with you. And folks, you can check it out. Go to the CUW logo on our website, and you can find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin there. And you can, get in touch with Dr. Voss, take one of his classes, and continue the conversation there. Well, I also have to say thanks to, today is Administrative Professionals Day, so I have to say thanks to Jenny and Joni, Mary and Sydney and Keisha, our intern, for all the work that they do to help us get our guests lined up on these programs on Faith and Family and all the other programs here at KFUO. They do a fantastic job of taking care of our guests, making them feel welcome and getting everybody lined up, as well as our listeners. So thanks to the great team. Coming up in just a little bit, we've got Moments of Assurance with Mark Hawkinson right here on Worldwide KFUO.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.